Turning now to the book of the prophet Haggai, chapter 1 and verse 1. Haggai chapter 1, verse 1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, saying. And we continue now in the time before us with our portrait of the prophets, and this evening the purpose and the message of Haggai. Well, it's 520 BC. Haggai has been so precise in introducing his visions, his messages, in the second year of Darius the king. He uses the kings of the Medo-Persian Empire as his reference for time. No longer are they going by the kings of Judah, because that's over, that's finished. There are no kings of Judah now. Judah has gone into captivity in Babylon. But now, of course, from 539 BC, with the fall of Babylon to the Medo-Persian Empire, now Cyrus, the king, the emperor, the emperor of the Medo-Persian Empire, has issued his Cyrus Edict and proclaimed liberty for the Jews as well as other nationalities to return to their homelands. And a large party of Jews have done so. They've left Babylon and some surrounding regions, and they've surged back to Jerusalem. And one of the prophets ministering to them in Jerusalem is Haggai. The other writing prophet ministering at the same time is the author of the following book, Zechariah. Well, this is the first group of returnees. We're familiar too with the books of Ezra and of Nehemiah. Well, it was some 80 years after this particular exodus, these people who returned at the time of Haggai, that another party returned, and they went under Ezra. And then some 13 years after that, yet a third party returned, and that was led by Nehemiah. But this is the first party, long before Ezra and Nehemiah. These are the people who returned soon after the fall of Babylon. Difficult to know precisely when, 538 BC, 537, some say 536, but in that one, 2 or 3 years after the fall of Babylon, some 50,000 return in this party. But there were probably many more, because while the book of Ezra tells us the numbers that came from Babylon to Jerusalem, it doesn't include in the numbering many Jews who came from the eastern side of the Babylonian Empire. So there may have been rather more, but there were at least 50,000 of them. And here they are. They come under the leadership of Zerubbabel. Now, he was a grandson of Jehoiakim, one of the last kings of Judah. He was of the line of David. He was royalty. He was a prince. He wasn't a king, of course. He was merely governor of this region under the Medo-Persian Empire, Jerusalem and surrounds. And with him came Jeshua, the high priest. And he also was descended from Aaron and from Zadok, the priest, indeed. So there was an authentic governor who was of the line of David. So the line of David is being preserved, restored back in Jerusalem, but not as a king over a self-governing nation, as a governor over just a rump, really. And then there is a genuine high priest. So that's the party, and many Jews also. But there were problems. When they got back to Jerusalem, well, it was rubble. It was in a terrible state. It had been rubble for nearly 50 years, ever since it was sacked by Nebuchadnezzar. and the fields were overgrown, and everything was in a deplorable condition, and this 50,000 plus had to make their homes and settle down and get farming, get sorting everything out, and they did so. Of course, this was the keen minority of Jews, one would have thought, because these were the ones who were eager to return and rebuild Jerusalem. Perhaps that was their dream anyway, and to rebuild the temple, certainly. Well, they got as far as laying the foundations for the temple, a very modified temple, much smaller than the previous temple, Solomon's temple, that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. But nevertheless, they laid the foundations, and they did that rather quickly, and they erected an altar, and they started the sacrifices. So worship and sacrifices were resumed. And then they stopped. Within a couple of years they'd accomplished that, and the work stopped. It stopped partly because of trouble from the Samaritans. They evoked a decree and had the work stopped. It was not properly done, and the Jews weren't strident enough in their defence of their project, and when there was opposition and trouble, they gave up, and they became demoralised. And for some 16 years, nothing happened. The temple stopped. There was no further progress. And that's the point at which we come into this, because Haggai is called of God to urge the people and stir them up, to bring them under conviction and to get them back to work. And that comes in this second verse of chapter 1. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. What a tragedy. These people who'd been keen enough to return, who'd had some vision, had been demoralized very quickly by the circumstances they found and the amount of work they had to do. But when they stopped with the great project of temple building, they didn't feel bad about it. They justified themselves. This is not the time, they said. They made excuses for themselves, and they down-tooled, and there was no further progress. And that's the essence of this charge which is brought by Haggai the prophet. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, look at it, the impatience of God almost with them, with the God of love. This people say, doesn't that breathe the impatience of God with the people, making excuses for themselves? The time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye? You see the repetition, he's stirring them. Haggai's words, you know, there are four prophecies in this book, or four words inspired by the Lord, addressed to the people. You can make five. The first one divides into two, but generally we take it that there are four. Strictly speaking, five. They're all given within a space of 4 months. Haggai may have ministered for some years prior to this. He'd obviously been in Babylon, in captivity. He'd come with the returnees. He probably ministered for some time, but that's a guess, because his written prophecies are all within the space of 4 months. He probably went on for some time afterwards too, but we don't know about that. The significant thing about Haggai is he's very plain and simple. He doesn't indulge in any soaring poetry. He doesn't write like Isaiah or like Ezekiel in quite a different style, or any of the famous prophets. He's very few words, straight to the point, very simple, very plain. And yet, for all that, he was given more instrumentality than many of the others. The others, and I'm not criticizing them, they all worked under inspiration, were given to utter tremendous words and amazing literature as we read it. And yet the people were stubborn and they wouldn't respond, and generation after generation would not turn back to the Lord. One word from Haggai, they all fall in line. And yet he's so plain and so direct, so unadorned. Anyway, look at his message. Is it time for you, this is verse 4, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house, that is the temple, lie waste? So much to the discredit of God, to his dishonour, that the children of Israel have returned, and the years are going by, and their witness to the world is that they are a weak people, and they cannot accomplish anything, and their God cannot rebuild his temple. So there is not a temple to the true God anywhere in all the world. There is nothing to the true God, no testimony. Is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses? The word is covered or hidden. Means to say, our translators have decided, it's the ceilings that were panelled. And they're very likely right. Only in the houses of the rich were the ceilings panelled. We take it for granted to have a flat plaster ceiling or something of that kind. But in those days, most people, they look straight into the roof space and the rafters and things of that type, or the under purlins of the flat roof, according to the kind of structure. But these are houses of rich people. They're ceilinged or panelled. Other people think it's the walls. That's equally possible. So they've gone to great lengths with ornamentation and decoration. Panelled houses, whether ceiling or wall, while the house of God lies waste. And they don't feel bad about it. They've justified it. This is not the time. Verse 5, now therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways, literally set your heart upon your ways in the Hebrew. If you've got a margin, it will tell you something along those lines, I'm sure. Be self-critical for a change. Examine your heart, make no excuses. We need to be told things like this sometimes, with our omissions and our slippings and slidings and our turning to worldly things, and Christian people who are neglecting the means of grace and the services of the Lord, and we need sometimes a word from the Lord to us. Look carefully on your ways. Don't make any excuses while you do so. Examine yourselves, accept the arrow of conviction, if the Lord sends it, and mend your ways. And that's how he speaks to them. Consider your ways. And then Haggai points out to them something they have not recognized willfully. Verse 6, ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. And so on. You have clothes, but you're not warm. You can't get the wool, you can't get the provisions and make enough. And he that earneth wages, well, it's like putting it into a bag with holes. And they have put all this down to natural causes. We sow, he'll go on to tell them this, we work, and yet the harvest is only half what it should be. Everything is running at half. There's something the matter, but it's natural causes. It hasn't occurred to them to say, it's God withholding these things from us. God is dealing with us, and things are not going as they should go. Everything is depleted, and we're just making excuses for our conduct. And it's so with us. We'll see it again in just a few verses' time. But God has his ways of dealing with his people and diminishing their happiness in some aspects of their lives. Maybe not diet or clothing or money, but maybe other things, friends and happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment and who knows, and health. But God has his ways of first of all gently and then more firmly shaking his people to think, you're not examining yourselves, you're not straightening your ways. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, verse 7, and it's repeated, consider your ways, set your heart upon your ways. And then verse 8 comes the abrupt command, go up to the mountain, They were used to that. I don't know which mountain, which hills, but there were forests there. And they'd taken from those forests to make that paneling for their ceilings and walls and the frames of their houses. Go up to the mountains and bring wood and build the house. Just get on with it. And I will take pleasure in it. What a promise. God will be pleased and he will bless. And I will be glorified, saith the Lord. No longer will the God of Israel be the poor God among the nations. There will be a people who serve him with vigor and enthusiasm. And there'll be a temple and a worship and a witness. And God will be glorified. That's the main point. But then the elaboration of the argument in chapter 1 and verse 9. Ye looked for much. There was every expectation of good harvests. Ye looked for much. And why not? It is implied the weather was right. The ground was right once you'd cleared it. You were experienced farmers. You knew what to do. Everything went well. And you had every reasonable expectation of a high yield. But it came to little. And you didn't draw the right conclusions. And when ye brought it home, I did blow upon it. The provisions wouldn't even keep. They seemed to wither and go off. They wouldn't store. Why, saith the Lord of hosts, because of mine house that is waste, and ye run, every man, unto his own house. Your priorities are all wrong. You're perpetually home building. And the more you home build, he says to them, the more I diminish you. And you don't see it and you don't recognize it. Your priorities are wrong. Well, I didn't mean this to be too stern for us tonight, but it may be that our priorities are wrong. And we put appearances and career and provisions and all kinds of things before the service or the worship of God. It can happen. Good Christian people can be thrown off course. Things go wrong in families. Children are sick. Fresh studies have to be followed. All sorts of things may take you off the track of regular attendance at prayer meetings and Bible studies for a time. Then when the problems are over, you don't return, and your priorities are wrong, and you go from weekend to weekend, maybe without Bible study, without fellowship, and God will begin to diminish you. Out of his kindness, he must train you in some way. He must start with the gentle disciplines. Because of mine house that is waste, and ye run, every man unto his own house. Priorities were wrong. Therefore, verse 10, the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. And it gets worse. This is God's way. Gentle disciplines at first, and if we ignore them, then it becomes firmer. Verse 11, and I called for a drought upon the land and upon the mountains. Now it's severe, and upon the corn, and upon the new wine, and so on. And not only that, I don't know what this means, but towards the end of verse 11, and upon men. What's happened to the men? Is the birth rate plunging? Are people sick and enfeebled? And upon cattle? And upon all the labour of the hands? So there's a diminishing overall. And that happens to us too. Verse 12. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God. That's tremendous. We're not used to seeing that. We've been following the prophets before the Jews were taken into captivity, and how hard was the work, and how seldom was the response of the people to the calls of God. But these people, first call of the very unadorned, plain-speaking Haggai, and the Spirit moves, and they obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet. Look at this. As the Lord their God had sent him, and the people did fear before the Lord. It was a marvellous response. It's a new generation. I suppose we would expect it. After all, they were the volunteers to return and get on with the work, we should expect a better response from them. They had gone wrong, but now they put it right, and they respond positively. But it was very quick, and within, when you count all the dates in this book, within 23 days, the entire company had mobilized, and they were down to work on those foundations, building the house. You can calculate it. All the dates are carefully given in the book. 23 days. They'd got the whole population to respond. That's very quick, because the Holy Spirit moved in their hearts. And they saw Haggai. They didn't, when they heard him preach this, they didn't say, "Who's he? Why is he telling us this? He doesn't know us that well. He's judging us," and all the rest of it. They heard the voice of God. He is speaking truly from God. This applies to us. We are to blame. And they responded, and that's a tremendous response. We can't always get that. They couldn't always get it in Bible times either. But we can't get it today. Happily, the majority of true believers in the Lord usually do respond. It's one of the wonderful things. People respond to the Word of God when they really love the Lord. But there's always some, and it's such a shame, you can't get them to move. You can't appeal to them. You can't move them. If they're offline on something or not trying hard enough, they won't listen, they won't respond. That's a very great shame. And it's a shame for them, because if they're truly the Lord's, God will have to move much more firmly toward them. Well, they feared the Lord with real reverence and desire. Verse 13, "Then spake Haggai, the Lord's messenger, in the Lord's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith the Lord." We'll deal with that in a few moments, because he repeats those words from the book of Exodus, the words of God, again. And verse 14, "The Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, and mightily, and not only him, but of Joshua, the high priest, and all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts, their God." And that's tremendous. God gave them love. God gave them desire. God gave them faith. And he gave them courage. The Samaritans wouldn't hold them up now. And he gave them determination. And he gave them a vision for the completion of the task, and also strength to carry on. They had been deeply affected by God diminishing them. The men seemed to have lost their strength and couldn't work as they previously had done. But now it surges back into them, and all hands to the work. And the day, verse 15, in the 24th day of the 6th month, and we can say exactly that that's 23 days after the first word that they heard. Now chapter 2. In the 7th month, and we're told that this equates to the 17th of October, 520 BC. In the 7th month, in the 21st day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, "Speak now to Zerubbabel and to Joshua, and to the residue of the people, saying," verse 3, "Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing?" This is a big and important point. Now, Haggai, if he had seen Solomon's temple before it had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, if he'd seen it, well, consider, he'd be somewhat over 70 now. If he was old enough when he saw it to remember it, he'd be 74, 75 by now. He rather gives the impression in this verse that he may have been among the oldies who had seen it. But certainly there were others, and the book of Ezra tells us this, that there were people, certainly among the priests and among the leaders of the people, who when they saw the new temple taking shape, and they remembered the old one, And they saw how small this was in comparison, and how rustic, how simple. There would be a mixture of weeping and gladness. Gladness because the temple was being constructed again. Weeping because it was nothing like the earlier one. And sometimes older people, and we who are older have to be very careful of this, sometimes older people, when they see how much worse present times are than times of long ago, they tend to be despondent. And everybody gets gloomy. And that seems to have been happening after the structure, the construction of this. Look again at verse 3 of chapter 2. Who is left among you? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it, the earlier one, as nothing? Of course, there were some serious differences. There was no holy flame. There was no Shekinah glory in this new temple. There was no ark. There were no cherubim. There were certain things missing. But even the very structure of it was vastly inferior. And so Haggai gives them a tremendous encouragement from God. Verse 4, yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, and be strong, all ye people of the land, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. And this is important to us, dear friends, because we live in a day of small things. We read the books, we know the history, we know there have been mighty times of revival. We live in the city of London. We can see, if we use our eyes, hundreds of buildings around London that were once churches and are not churches any longer, converted into something else. There are so few churches by comparison with long ago, and so many of those that exist are very worldly and off track in their idea of what Christian worship is and the Christian message. And we could become despondent, especially the older people who remember even 40, 50, 60 years ago, even as recently as that. That may not seem recent to you, but even as recently as that, things were so much better than they are now. And then the books, and times of awakening, and times of revival. And how do you get your voice heard now? How do you get across to the public? Electronic media has come in, and everything else, and all the powers of entertainment, and just taken over the minds of the people. And churches are non-entities. We're obscure. We cannot lift up our voices and reach the crowds. If we go into the open air, we're drowned by the mighty roar of traffic. So we begin to feel, how can ever we reach large numbers again? And our feelings are akin to those of the people who saw this new small temple appearing on the scene. But God is with them. Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel. Don't worry about the fact that we're in a different age with great forces arranged against us. God will use this smaller temple. He is in it. It will glorify him. Actually, it stood, wait for it, it stood for 351 years. That's not bad, before it was destroyed. This present tabernacle, now the basement is old, but the structure above us has stood for little more than 50 years. And the tabernacle that was above us before that stood for rather shorter time. And the one before that, an even shorter time. And this mere 50 years plus is the longest structure we've had. That temple, which they were inclined to despise, the oldest, stood for 351 years. That's not bad, is it? No wonder God says to them, be strong. I have a purpose in this. It's nothing like what you think, and it's the same with us. Carry on in gospel work. It's all the more glorious in a day of small things. It's all the more glorious when atheism and materialism and unbelief seems to be so powerful. And the people come in and are saved in ones and twos and threes, not in scores and hundreds, But God is with us. He knows what he's doing. And our business is to be as faithful and as bold as we can be. And that's the word here. Be strong, O Zerubbabel. Now verse 5 of chapter 2, we must hurry. According to the word, God is going to be with them. According to the word that I covenanted with you when ye came out of Egypt, 11 centuries before, God said he would be with them. And now he says, my spirit remaineth among you, fear ye not. And so it would be that the remnant, the faithful remnant of Jews who truly believed in him and served him, would keep the presence of God. And they would be preserved through thick and thin. And now Zion is the church of Jesus Christ, the Jewish Gentile International Church of Jesus Christ. And God is still with us and will be with us to the end. And his power is undiminished. And look at the encouragement that Haggai is inspired to give them. Chapter 2, verse 6. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once again, we should read, would make it clearer to us, yet once more. Something's yet is going to happen. Yet once more. It is a little while, it won't be long, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations. Here's a tremendous word of prophecy. Within 40 years of these words, the Medo-Persian Empire would be shattered and finished. It would happen at first gradually, and then there would be decisive battles, particularly in 479 BC, two decisive battles which would lead to the ascendancy of the Greeks. Within 40 years, within about 30 years, it will start to be really shaken to its roots. In a little while, there's going to be tremendous international turmoil. This empire, Medo-Persian Empire, will be gone. Then there'll be the empire of the Greeks, and that in its turn will be shattered and dispersed by the Roman Empire, and that in turn will collapse and implode. And there's going to be now centuries of great variation, and the scene will become unrecognizable as the centuries go by. I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. Now, I'm going to ask for your concentration for a moment, because here is a pivotal point in this remarkable prophecy of Haggai, and there are two ways of understanding it. Some of the modern versions tend to translate it a little differently. That which is desired of all nations will come. And they see the prophecy as meaning this. And mark you, this is true, and it's prophesied elsewhere. In Isaiah, numerous times, and particularly in chapter 60. So this construction is true, but it's not actually, I don't think, the one that is meant. The prophecy means this, say many people, and good people. They say, the time is coming, the time of the Gentiles. Don't worry that this temple that you're building has none of its silver and gold. It's all been stolen, taken away. But the silver and gold is mine. This is one interpretation. And the time is coming when what is considered desirable among nations, that is silver and gold and riches, will pour into the temple. It'll come into Zion, into the church of God, because the Gentiles are going to be called. And they will come, many, many people from every land and nation, and they'll be saved, and they'll bring their faith and their love and their stewardship and their means into the church of Jesus Christ. Now that is one interpretation of the passage. So look at chapter 2 and verse 7. I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations, or that which is desired among nations, shall come. And I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. That is to say, from Jerusalem will go out the gospel of Christ, and the nations will come to it. Well, that will literally happen, and indeed it has happened. But our translation goes the other way, and it says specifically, the desire of all nations shall come, which is clearly a reference to the Messiah. And I think the translators are right in rendering it in this way. There's going to be turmoil among the nations, and then Christ will come, and he'll reign, he'll gather in his people, there'll be the church age, and then finally he'll come again. Now the prophets never distinguish between the first and the second coming of Christ. When Haggai says, in line with all the writing prophets, the desire of all nations or the Messiah will come, he sees it all, or is inspired to see it, as one event. Christ will come, he'll suffer and die on Calvary, he'll purchase salvation for his people, the church age will ensue, then he will come in judgment. But that whole process, the redeeming appearance of Christ, the church age, his second coming in glory, is all one to the Old Testament prophets. But the desire of all nations shall come. Why is he the desire of all nations? Well, that is to say, he is the desire of all those who love him among all the nations, all those who found him. The desire of all nations will come. It's precious, it's valuable. Right now, there are people in Eritrea who are languishing in prison and half-starved, and they're Christians and they love the Lord, and they've come under persecution, and they're looking for the desire of all nations, how they desire him. That he'll come and terminate all the opposition and cruelty in the world. There are men and women, dear ladies, imprisoned in dungeons in parts of Pakistan, and they're cut off from their families, and their families are persecuted, and they, some of them, are under sentence of death. And Christ to them is their comfort day by day, and they desire him. He's the desire of all nations. When he comes, it will be to deliver the sufferers wherever they are, in North Korea, in Somalia, in other places also. And all believers, when you see the times, and you see the dishonor to God, and you see the things that are said publicly and widely publicized by the more extreme wings of atheism, and the hatred and the contempt that prevails, he's the desire of all nations, and you long for him to come and to be given his honor and his glory, and for this sin-sick world to be brought to an end. Home for the sufferers, bliss for all the people of God. And we love him because of what he's done for us on Calvary's cross, and the way he's brought us, and who he is, and what he represents to us. Oh, he's the desire of all nations. So this is the great prophecy. Work on, says God through Haggai. I will shake the nations, and in due course the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory. Not that temple that they were just building literally, the house of God, the temple to the Jews of old, meant that institution, whether it's Solomon's temple or Zerubbabel's temple or Herod's temple, it's the temple. So they didn't necessarily, there had been a previous temple, and before that the tabernacle. The Jews didn't think that the prophecy of Haggai referred exclusively, literally, to this structure, the temple institution. And of course, when Christ came, he is the temple. And indeed, the New Testament makes both Christ the temple and the people of God, the church, are viewed as the temple. His house are we, says the letter to the Hebrews. And so, when the prophecy is that there'll be great glory to God through this temple, I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. It's a reference to Christ and his church. And then I hurry towards the end. And in this place, verse 10, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. Better days are coming, and in this place will I give peace, communion with myself, and oneness. And then another prophecy, verse 10, in the 24th day of the 9th month, everything is so precise. We're told it's the 18th of December, 520 BC. Came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law. And two questions are asked. Now, these we'll deal with very briefly. Verse 12 of chapter 2. If one bear holy flesh, that's meat that has been part of a sacrifice, it's consecrated, it's holy flesh, there it is being carried in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt he touches some other item, bread, some foodstuff, shall that other item become holy because it's been touched by something that was consecrated, something that was ceremonially clean? And the priests, without hesitation, say no. Ceremonial cleanness cannot be communicated. Something is ceremonially clean for worship. You go around touching things with it, it doesn't make them clean. You cannot communicate ceremonial cleanness. So that's the first issue. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these foodstuffs, shall it be unclean? And the priests answered, yes. Now, under the old way of worship, something that had been sanctified and purified, that was holy, could not communicate its holiness to anything else. But if something was unholy, then if it touched you, you were ceremonially unclean. But the purpose of this is to make an analogy, and it is this. The application by Haggai is along these lines. Well, then look to yourselves. You've got the answer right. But here you've been going along to your altar and you've been worshipping and the ritual and the service has been fine. But that cannot make you clean in the sight of God. Those are lessons and pictures of God's holiness and the care with which he needs to be approached. To have something which is, in the ancient worship, ceremonially consecrated doesn't make you a better person. You worship, you go through those rituals, but you've got to cleanse your own heart before God. You've got to seek his pardon and redirect your ways and obey him and please him. That's going to be the application of what is not actually a passage anything like as difficult as it looks. Verse 14, then answered Haggai and said, so is this people and so is this nation before me. And there is the need for them to be clean in their ways. But a great promise that now, because they have exercised faith and they've got down to the work, now the harvests will improve and things which will be much better. And I close then just coming back to the end of the book in verse 20. Again, the word of the Lord came unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month, precise dating again. Speak to Zerubbabel, verse 21, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth. And just listen to this as the prophecy closes. And I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. In that day, this is clearly moving towards the end of time, the final judgment. It's spanning the centuries. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, but surely he'll be long dead. Ah, yes, but he represents, he's a prince of the royal line of David. He represents the Davidic line, which of course brings the Messiah, Jesus Christ. He represents the church. I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and I will make thee as a signet, whether a ring or some other article was the legal entity of the person, your signet or your seal of an important person, and that you didn't want to lose. I will make thee as a signet, a representative, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. And the promise means this: amidst all the turmoil and all the upheaval of the coming years, until Christ comes, and then throughout the history until Christ comes again, the church, the people of God, in their faithfulness, will be kept safe by God. You know, the Jews had to go through fearful times. Before the coming of Christ, particularly in the preceding 2 centuries, they had to go through tremendous sufferings. But they were never wiped out, as other national groups were. They were never exterminated. A remnant was kept and protected. There would always be a line from David. The Jewish nation was preserved to bring forth the Messiah. And the church will be preserved. There will always be a church of Jesus Christ to the end of time, however great the hostility, however many our enemies. The gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. One old divine made this comment: how fortunate is any nation that has within it a thriving church, because God is going to protect that church and the nation may benefit. What an amazing thing. They won't do it, but these days there are forces at work in our land, as you well know, that would like to eradicate the church. Can't be done in a physical way, not yet at any rate, these days. But the intellectual assault and the legal assault also, the political assault, is getting stronger and stronger to get rid of Christian witness and belief and testimony and to tread it down. And what a terrible thing for the land. If they ever succeeded in doing that, it would be the worse for the land. Why, the preservation of a land depends upon the fact that there is a thriving church within it, because God will protect that, and God will keep that, and the land will benefit to a remarkable degree. But they won't get rid of us, because we are God's signet. He will keep his people to the very end of time, and we, for our part, must be all out for him and do keep our spiritual duties and honour him and keep his glory above all else. That's all we have time for, but that's the message of Haggai. Let's close this evening.